Well, welcome to our audit committee for Charnwood Borough Council. As you've seen, this is now being recorded and will be made available on the website of Council. So please do switch on and switch off your microphones and speak into them. And remind each other, I guess, as well. Under the Openness of Local Government Bodies regulations, people may film or record this meeting and it's outside of Council's control. But they should do so in a way that doesn't disrupt the business of the meeting. And please could you all remember to turn your mobile phones either off or onto silent. And please turn off your smart speakers, Alexa, Siri, as these record conversations and could be a breach of GDPR. Now, we've been set a bit of a line in the sand about the length of the meeting because I understand scrutiny was kept on track yesterday, so there's our challenge, I think. We've got a time limit of 2.5 hours, and if it's still ongoing at that point, we can vote on whether to extend it by half an hour, but only to finish that item that we're already on. We do have quite a packed agenda, but hopefully we will get through everything. Could I ask everybody to confirm verbally that you're present and you can see and hear everything? So, Councillor Bolton?
I'm here and I can see and hear.
Councillor Bradshaw?
Thank you, Chair. I'm here and I can see and hear the proceedings.
Thank you. Apologies if I mispronounce your name, Councillor Haji Nicolaou.
Yeah, it's Haji Nicolaou. It's a Greek name. Thank you, Chair. I'm here and can see and hear you.
Thank you. Councillor Baldwin, I believe, isn't here.
He's not coming today, Chair, because we have quorum plus one to ensure social distancing.
Thanks, Ed. Councillor Parsons?
Yes, I'm here and can see and hear, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Snart?
Yeah, I'm here and I can see and hear. Thank you.
Marvellous. And also everybody else. So we've got Mark from Mazars.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And yes, I can see and hear all proceedings.
Adrian, Head of Strategic Support.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I'm here.
Leslie, Head of Finance and Property.
Thank you, Chair. I can see and hear.
Thank you. Simon?
Yes, thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Lisa Marin from Audit?
Yes, thank you, Chair.
Kerry from Audit? Thank you. You have to shout a bit more without a microphone. Helen Gritton?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I can see you here.
Thank you. Nikki Conway?
Yes, I'm here, Chair.
Thank you. And Ed?
Here, Chair.
Thank you. Joining us later will be Peter Oliver, Head of Landlord Services for Item 8, and Richard Bennett, Head of Planning and Regeneration, and Maria French, the Sustainability Officer for Item 11. I think we've been round everybody. There's nobody else present? Lovely. Okay, so let's move on to the first item on our agenda, which is apologies.
We have apologies from Justin Henry. I believe Simon Jackson will be presenting his report.
Lovely, thank you. Our next item is the minutes of the previous meeting on the 9th of February. Please could you confirm verbally that you're content to receive and to note the minutes. So Councillors Bolton, Bradshaw, Jean Nicolaou, Parsons and Snart.
I confirm that I'm happy to accept and agree the minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I just make one little point? Sorry, this is the marking room. On page 6, I presume in the paragraph 49, the last paragraph, it should say, however, this could be changed if the end of your audit report was pushed back. Just a slight correction.
Sorry, I don't know where you are.
Just above the, it's page 6 of the minutes, page 9 of the full pack. In the paragraph above Part 50. Just a minor spelling. Yep. Thank you, Ed. Okay, if we go on to item 3, which is our agenda variants.
Sorry, Chair, have the other members of the committee agreed the minutes?
Oh. Sorry.
Yeah. Happy, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Happy to and agree the minutes.
Madam Chairman, I wasn't here, so it's very difficult for me to suggest one way or the other.
Yeah.
I think, Chair, you have confirmation from the majority of members who were here that they're happy with the minutes?
Yep. Thank you. Happy to agree the minutes. Sorry, let's move on to agenda item 3, the agenda variants. So it's the election of the vice chair. Is everybody happy? Could you confirm verbally that you are content with this variance to the agenda?
Yeah. I think, Chair, we have a bit of confusion in that the order of proceedings still refers to people confirming verbally, which was what we were doing when we were having virtual meetings. So I would advise if members are happy to go back to the usual show of hands, that might be the clearest way to do it.
Yes. Okay. Sorry. So do we have a proposal for vice chair? Or shall I hand this over to you, Ed?
I think, Chair, one of the members of the committee needs to propose somebody to become vice chair.
Do we have any proposals for vice chair?
I propose Councillor Parsons.
But you have a proposer and seconder, Chair. I think you now need to ask people by show of hands whether they are in favour of that proposal.
Is everybody in favour of this as a proposal? I think we have confirmation there.
Do I need to swap suits?
No.
Okay, thank you. Moving on to item 5, disclosure of interests. Does anybody have an interest to declare at this point?
I'm just interested if we do need to say something about the allowances and expenses by councillors. Do we? Could I just get a confirmation from Adrian, please?
I think, Chair, my advice would be that it's an item for information only, and I think it's accepted that all councillors, by definition, will be appearing on that list. So my advice would be you don't have to declare an interest.
Are there any other declarations of interest? No? Okay. Shall we? Happy to move on to the next item? Lovely. Okay, so item 6 is questions under other committee procedures. There were no questions submitted, unless any have been submitted since, Ed?
None submitted since, Chair.
Okay. Thank you. So moving on to item 7, the annual audit letter. I'll hand over to Mark.
Thank you, and good evening to you all. I will keep this as brief as I possibly can do, because the annual audit letter for 2019-20 coming to you in June of 2021 is merely a feature of the fact that there's been elections and rather other pressing matters for the authority to deal with. All I will do is take you to page 13 of the pack. Everything in this report has been through the committee cycle previously. Page 13 of the pack, though, is an executive summary, and you may or may not have yours in colour print, but I can tell you that all of our areas of responsibility for 2019-20, we concluded, were what we would say is green-rated, which is clean opinions on the financial statements, clean opinions on all the other information, such as the annual governance statement and the narrative report, a clean value for money conclusion, and I won't go through the rest because it will get a bit repetitive. But that is all that I intend to say about this report.
Thank you, Mark. Does anybody have any questions?
It's just a point of clarity. That on page 15, the financial statement materiality of 1.552 million, it says that's 2% of gross expenditure. Is that gross expenditure of the general fund plus what I term the revenue bit of the HRA account? How's that generated? Where's that figure from? Because that's roughly 75 million is the total gross expenditure. And I'm just trying to add that together to get the figures from which accounts.
Certainly, and this will come up in the next paper as well in terms of our approach. We take it from gross revenue expenditure, which is on the face of the financial statements, so it would include the housing revenue expenditure as well as the general fund expenditure. It's circa £75 million because you will include areas such as housing benefits expenditure in there, which would be circa £25-30 million. So it ratchets up very quickly. Oh, and it will include areas of non-general fund and non-HRA accounting entries that will go through the accounts as well, such as depreciation.
That's fine. Are there any other questions, Mark? Okay, lovely.
Madam Chairman, could I just say, and I think with all the greens running right down, I think officers should be congratulated as well for bringing this forward and getting us to a position that the statements say.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Mark. Okay, if we move on to item 8, the audit strategy memorandum. And again, over to Mark.
Thank you, and I will spend slightly longer on this report just because I appreciate it's A, it's more relevant into exactly where we are now, and B, that there are some complexities that sit within the report that it warrant me giving you my interpretation of where to draw your attention to. What I will do first is take you to page 29 of the pack, which sets out our engagement and responsibilities summary. There's a number of aspects in here, but the key ones for me is that it's our responsibility for issuing an opinion on the financial statements, first and foremost. We also have a duty around the value for money commentary. There is a substantial change in the way that we carry out our work this year, and I will take you through that shortly. There are also electors' rights. So a local elector can object to the accounts or ask questions of the auditor. So we give them that opportunity to do so. Lastly, I would point out our responsibilities to fraud. It is not our responsibility to detect fraud, but to design appropriate procedures around that. The next area I'd like to take you to is all the way through to page 37 of your pack. That is page 13 of our report. This page includes a small diagram with where we believe the most significant risks in the financial statements are. We've set out four areas on the diagram. The first audit risk is called the management override of controls. This is an audit risk that is prevailing in any organisation. It is not to say there is a heightened risk within you as a council. It is a mandatory risk in the audit standards. The second area of financial reporting risk lies around the defined benefit valuation. That is the pension scheme. The pension scheme involves very, very large numbers based on complex actuarial assessments, judgments and estimates, and therefore we spend additional time having a look at the underlying estimates and ensuring that the financial reporting around that is correct. The third area is the valuation of land and buildings. The authority has a very large value of land and buildings in the balance sheet. It's supported by a professional valuer and involves judgments and estimates, and therefore, similar to the pension fund, we spend additional time and effort reviewing the key information that sits behind that and ensuring that the financial reporting of those is correct or fairly stated. Those three or four mentioned risks are consistent with the previous year. The fourth area is COVID-19 grant recognition. Now, first and foremost, what I need to talk to you about is ensuring that you do not take false assurance from our work. What we are looking at here is the financial reporting elements. So that is about taking which grants will end up in your financial statements and which ones will not end up in the financial statements. For example, you will all be aware that there are numerous millions and millions of pounds worth of business rate grants that came through, that essentially the authority passported through to business rate payers. The accounting judgment we're looking at is, should that be disclosed in your financial statements or not? Not, we will not be testing the eligibility of those business grants. We're looking at, should it be in your accounts or not? And if it is it fairly stated? So it's a different kind of approach. And like I said, I do not want to give you any false assurance that we're going to be testing whether those grants were issued correctly. We're looking at the accounting arrangements. It's what we call a significant risk because it's new. It's big numbers involved and it's new. We don't have any particular concerns over how you've done anything, but because it's large and it's new, we believe it's appropriate that we spend some time just making sure the accounting treatment is correct. The next area of the report I'm going to take you to is the value for money conclusion element. And what I would like to do is take you to page 44 of the pack. Page 44 of the pack sets out three columns. For the 2020-21 financial year, there is a new code of audit practice established by the National Audit Office. That code of practice creates an entirely new approach to how we perform our work on the authority's arrangements for value for money. In previous years, we issued a conclusion. This year, we will not be issuing a conclusion. We will be issuing a detailed commentary on what arrangements the authority has in place, and it will cover these three areas on this page. So we will report back through what's called through a value for money commentary report that will go in the public domain, and it will cover what arrangements, so the controls, the processes that the authority has in place to secure financial sustainability, your governance, and how you go about using costs and performance to improve the way you deliver your services. So again, we're not going to be commenting on, so we are really driven by the arrangements, and these are all deliberately being put in here so you have something to reflect on when we come back to the commentary about how we've covered all of these aspects. Each of these aspects in here are expected to be in place in any public sector organisation. Most will come from your existing annual governance statement. Some may not. Ultimately, this is essentially a blank piece of paper that we need to review. So there's significant additional work that we need to do this year, as well as the commentary. And by issuing that commentary that goes in a public domain, you can understand that our risk management procedure is about making sure our commentary is fair, balanced, and a complete perspective is a little bit harder than it would have been previously, where all we did was report by exception. I don't intend to go through any other aspect of the report, but it is important for me to assure you as a committee that we remain independent and objective, and there are no matters affecting our ethical considerations about carrying out our audit for you. Having said that, I am more than happy to take any questions. But before I do, I did remember, members may or may not have received an email. We are running a webinar on the 24th of June for covering the basics and fundamentals of an audit committee. I think I will probably send the email through to Ed, if that's all right, Ed, and he will circulate it around. It's open for both new members and existing members, but will hopefully be a useful briefing around the key fundamental aspects.
Thank you, Mark. Are there any questions? Mr. Parsons.
Thank you, Chair. I've just got a couple of things you've said, and just one sort of might seem a bit of an odd clarification. Go back to page 37, please. I'm surprised management override of controls is deemed to have greater financial impact than the benefit liability of the pension or the value of land and buildings. What's the justification for that having a greater financial impact? Because I would have thought override of management control would be limited to what any individual manager's got the ability to override, whereas I would have thought the scale of pension and land and buildings was greater in terms of a financial impact.
Do you want me to take each one in turn?
Yeah, it's better to take one in time. One at a time, that would be good, thanks.
So there's some judgment around where the diagram goes. The critical thing around management over controls is it's principally around the use of estimates, and therefore includes all estimates, including the pension and the valuation of land and buildings. Plus, it includes the use of accounting journals. It is reasonable and appropriate for me to say that there has been, unfortunately, an increase in the level of financial reporting fraud over the last 12 months. And not too far from here, as is in the public domain, was a financial reporting issue at University Hospitals Leicester. Therefore, we have, we are professionally sceptical rather than deliberately sceptical about arrangements that are in place. But it is appropriate that we spend due time and diligence looking at that.
Second point, you spoke about the COVID grant recognition, and you have to make a judgment about what goes in and out. What affects that judgment about what goes in and what goes out into the accounts? What are you looking at to say, oh, that should go in, that shouldn't?
Certainly. So, first to clarify, it's not our judgment. It's the finance team's judgment, first and foremost. They will be driven by the accounting standards. The accounting standards follow essentially what is called a flow chart, which uses the terms principal and agent. So where the authority is the defining principal and therefore the defining beneficiary, the figures that the grant should go in the financial statements. A simple example of that would be, why can't I think of a simple example of that? A simple example of that might be a revenue support grant. So something very specific that the authority is responsible for delivering, a service that the authority is delivering. Where it is an agent, it is acting on behalf of another agency. So if you take the business rates grants that were passported through to business rate players, it was not the authority that was responsible for... the authority was only passing the funds through on behalf of another body. It's not to say that there shouldn't be appropriate controls and procedures and checks in place, but our responsibility relies around the financial statements, and there are predefined accounting standards that do that.
In effect, my summary of that is it's about whether it's a direct service of ours or we're a conduit. Is the decision that our finance team are making. Okay.
One of the aspects is around. One of the aspects on which we will comment is the audit committee, and we will do that by attending meetings. If we have significant concerns, we will raise them. Of course, we would, because it's appropriate that we do things before they become an issue. Just by being an elected member does not make you competent. However, participating. As we say, this is something that we'll cover as part of our webinar, and that's not self-promotion. I just think it's really pertinent with this new code that people should be cognizant of the responsibilities of an audit committee at this point. So you will, and it's not about individual members, it's about the collective and the collective responsibility, as well as the level of support and officer support that comes through.
Last one, thank you. Just very general. Why did they change the measurements for this year? What's the rationale behind it?
So this has been coming for a number of years. The consultation was in 2019, I believe. The critical piece has been there's been a number of criticisms that where organisations have been seen to be not acting on auditor advice, the value for money conclusion has had too narrow a scope, and therefore there have been some high-profile failings that were not properly addressed, the most notable one being the Northamptonshire County Council, who did have qualified value for money conclusions for a number of years. So the auditor did all of the right things, but the authority failed to respond. So this new code of audit practice gives us far more teeth. Where organisations are not performing effectively, we have greater powers to enact on that.
Do you have the teeth, or do you pass the teeth to this committee with what you write? So, in other words, the teeth are yours and you act independently of us, or you bring that in via the report and expect us to act?
It's judgmental. So we do have the teeth, we do have powers to enact, and we can issue statutory notices and statutory recommendations that will put an all stop. However, it may be more judgmentally, we may raise recommendations that are far more appropriate for the authority to deal with.
That means officers.
We will share them with the audit committee, but it will always be for officers to implement, and therefore the audit committee's role would be in being assured that those recommendations are being implemented.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mark? No? So are we happy to note the report? Yes? Thank you. Okay, we'll move on to the next item, the annual governance statement and review of the Code of Corporate Governance. So if I hand this over to Lisa to introduce it to you.
Sorry, Chair, I think it's the annual audit letter. I'm getting confused now myself. My annual report. Is it next? Is that the next item? Yeah. Is that okay?
Yeah. That's fine, sorry.
Thank you. So this is my annual report, and there are a number of items that have to be included in the annual report. The first being my overall opinion on the adequacy and effectiveness of the control environment. So based on all the work that internal audit have carried out at Charnwood during 2020-21, I'm able to give reasonable assurance in that there is generally a sound system of governance, risk management and control in place, with some issues of non-compliance or scope for improvement that have been identified during our audit work. I should note that this is a positive opinion overall. The report includes a summary of all our internal audit work during the year. The committee do receive the full details of all of our work through the quarterly progress reports. I'm required to flag up any issues that I consider relevant to the annual governance statement, and you'll see in section 4 that I've referenced the asbestos management report specifically, as this is our only limited opinion report issued during the year. Peter Oliver, the head of Landlord Services, is joining us for the next item to aid with the consideration of as a part of that of part of the progress report. It's also a requirement for me to include details of our quality assurance and improvement programme, and that's included at section 5, and a statement on conformance with the public sector internal audit standards. And as the committee will know, following our external inspection in December 2020, I can confirm that we did not have any gaps in compliance during the year. I'm happy to take any questions if there are any specifically on the report.
Thank you, Lisa. I'd like to comment that it was good that the issues around the asbestos one had already been picked up by the compliance manager, who was new to post and was acting on that already, so that's reassuring to see. And I was also, I guess, pleasantly surprised about the outstanding recommendations, and there isn't any quite old recommendations. So, well done to audit for that, I think. I think in other audit committees, in other areas, there are some quite old audit recommendations outstanding.
Thank you, Chair. I think there is a good relationship between our audit and services. There is quite a good relationship between our audit and services in terms of
an agreed process for following up progress against recommendations. There was a lot of internal audit activity in the last 6 months of the year, and actually a lot of audit reports that have been issued since January. So there will be a lot more audit recommendations that will be falling due later on in the year, and we'll continue to update committee on that through the progress reports. But generally there's an agreed system that then if recommendations aren't being implemented as agreed, we've chased up a couple of times, we'd then flag that up with the director, flag it up with SLT if we needed to, and hopefully a last resort, the audit committee would have to push that as well.
Thank you, Lisa. I was going to offer the support for the audit committee, because that's quite an effective route that they might be asked to come and answer questions about it. So please do consider that option's there as well. Councillor Snart.
Thank you. Just looking at an area probably I know a little bit about, planning and regeneration. When you look at the developed control, how do you approach that in terms of its vast size of it and all the bits that they do there? I'm just telling you about, or I suppose thinking about, it's just gone to outsourcing planning applications, and how would you actually deal with that, or did you deal with that within that report, or could you just give us an indication of what you did when the developed control audit was done?
Thank you. So when we look at development control, we focus on the arrangements that are in place at the that the planning team have got in place to thoroughly go through the applications as they come in, so making sure that it goes through the correct process as per the policies that are set by the team. We look at the legislation that's applicable in terms of performance standards that are being reported and that kind of thing. We look at the appeals process. We look at the fees. So there's a whole range of aspects of the service that we look at when we're doing a development control audit. But primarily it will be the internal policies and procedures that we'll work to. But particularly in development control, we do look at how that works as well and take a view on training that might be given to the planning committee, so that there's a whole range that we look at.
So could I just come back and just say, now they're outsourcing the sort of planning applications, will that be part of the actual audit that you will do?
It isn't on this year's audit plan, but each year we discuss with the head of service and with the directors which areas should be included. If it is going to be outsourced and it's going to be a contract, then that may feature on our audit plan as part of that. If it does, then that would be more from the point of view of looking at how Charnwood are managing that contract. Here, first. Sorry.
Thank you. Before I start, could I ask for the curtains to be closed, please, because I can't actually see anything at all. Thank you. Lisa, just a really quick question. I hope it doesn't seem too trivial. On page 71, Appendix C, customer satisfaction surveys, you received 3 for 2021. All positive overall. How many surveys did you actually issue? Because it said you did them after every audit. Because a return of only 3 really is very, very low, and it concerns me that we're taking assurance that things are okay because 3 of the customers said it was okay. So thank you.
It has actually gone up to 4 since the time of writing the report. We don't take the approach of following up after we've issued it. So after we've done an audit, we send a link to the satisfaction survey. This was one of the things I was going to pick up actually moving forwards to discuss with senior management as to whether they would like us to chase that up, because actually we do get a higher response rate at our other partner authorities, so Northwest and Blaby, we do get a higher number of returns. So I suppose as a service, internal audit service that we provide to 3 authorities, we get good feedback from those as well. So it isn't just the 4 that we get from Charnwood. I'm just reporting those because they are specific to Charnwood. So yeah, it's something to take forward as to whether we want to see that increased. It's not something that we chase up, we issue it. Obviously we do want to have positive feedback, but sometimes if we issue a negative audit report, it might not be a good thing to get too much positive feedback as an internal audit service. So we ask for it and we welcome it, and we welcome the opportunities to learn, but as I say, we haven't chased up to date.
Thank you, Lisa. Councillor Parsons.
Two questions on 68 and 69. It's not really tongue-in-cheek, it is very slightly. From the outside, members of the public might think it odd that we spend 11 and a half days on the tree preservation order and 3.5 on the main accounting and budgetary control. I recognise there may be issues behind that, but from an outside perspective, whose voice we partly are in this room, it looks odd that's such a significant. It's 3 times the effort into tree preservation orders than went into what's classified here as the main accounting and budgetary control systems. Is there sort of like a one-liner rationale behind that?
So as I noted on the report, the tree preservation area was a new area for the auditor who did it, so there was a lot more time taken in terms of researching. I suppose the main accounting system, the 3.5 days, actually masks some of the extra work that we did on that. Because we did that audit last, we were actually able to take assurance from the other key financial system audits that we'd done during the final quarter. So some elements would overlap with, say, creditors, payroll, some of the reconciliations and things. So we were already able to say we've tested that on that audit. So the 3.5 days isn't indicative if we were just doing a standalone main accounting system audit per se.
Thank you, Chair. Second point is something slightly similar but different. That the 17 days for payroll, where we make the observation that we exceeded due to level of testing, was that because we had a set level of testing going into the audit and each test took longer, or did we continue to do more testing because we had concerns or we needed to establish greater certainty?
There were a few reasons that took longer. Partly that was getting to grips with that being a remote audit, and historically that had not been done remotely, and the auditor had always sort of just been able to go along and get check herself, really, and be able to do it a lot quicker. So that really flagged up to us to make sure that we were working as efficiently as possible when we were doing our audits. It was high for, it is a high number of days for a substantial audit. We didn't have to do extended testing. It was just a bit of a combination of things as to how the audit was being conducted remotely, the time it took to get the information required to conclude that, and possibly that assurance could have been taken at an earlier stage. So that's something that we're working on within the audit team.
Thank you, Lisa. I think this year's thrown up a lot of challenges for audit teams in particular. Well, everybody in new ways of working and trying to work around them to get the required information we need. Thank you. Are we happy to accept the report? I think that's full acceptance. Thank you very much for that. And so I think we have somebody else joining us now. So we're moving on to the internal audit progress report for the current period. And again, over to Lisa.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just briefly introduce, I know Peter's joining us. It was just to flag up, as mentioned, a lot of final reports have been issued in this reporting period, and actually since the time of writing we have issued another final report, and I think you'll be getting one tomorrow and one next week as well, and then that will fully conclude everything for 2021. The executive summaries are all included at Appendix B, and the committee does receive all the reports in full. As I mentioned, we were only able to give limited assurance to the asbestos management audit, and Peter's here if there are any detailed questions about that and the improvement actions, and also Kerry did the audit, so again would be able to assist committee if there's any further questions. We have started work on the 21-22 audit plan. Asset management and commercial property audits are at the planning stage. We're also carrying out a lot of work at the moment, again, on the new business grants that are being issued, the restart, and also continuing with the assurance regimes for the original grant schemes as well. I haven't included the 21-22 plan in this report, as there's no outcomes at this time, but I will from the next report that comes to committee, as hopefully you'll be starting to see then reports coming through. I'm happy to take any questions on the report itself, and also then pass to Peter if there's anything on, in particular on asbestos management.
Thank you, Lisa. Any questions?
Could I just ask
from the asbestos management audit, has that impacted on our residents in terms of tenants and such, and how's that impacted through that, and is there any more work to be done on that?
I think through the actions that have been identified in the audit, what we'll get is greater assurance in terms of tenant safety. We've now got a new compliance manager in post, I think, as the board may have the committee may have heard previously, and every confidence now we've got that resource in place, we'll be able to drive this forward. And of course, the new compliance manager will be supported to deliver the recommendations as well. So the impact through this audit and on tenant safety will be a positive one.
Thank you, Peter. We've got another question from Councillor Paul.
I don't have that statistic. I think you asked how many asbestos-related illnesses did we have in... We don't collect that type of data. What I can say is that there's no particular reports of that within the workforce, and the workforce is subject to regular monitoring through occupational health through our existing arrangements, but I don't have a kind of regional data in respect of it.
Thank you, Chair. Some of the implementation dates are quite extended. So, you know, we've got April 2022 is, I think, the longest I can find for what is essentially the 2021 audit report. So, you know, that's a full year away from the implementation date. Do we, and I'm not quite sure who I mean by we, do we, the internal auditors and this committee, collectively push back when an implementation date is set? Or does the department set the implementation date and say that's when we're going to do it by, and we go, okay, because the department has said that's when it's going to be done by? How does that date get agreed, and by whom, before it appears in front of us? Who said okay, or pushed back on that, or said we need it quicker or slower?
It's generally a discussion is had between the auditor and the head of service or the service manager as to what is reasonable and feasible in the time. Usually you would see the high priority recommendations with an earlier target implementation date, but that might not always be the case depending on what's involved to get that recommendation fully implemented. So there's some judgment there as to what's involved, how long things may take. Sometimes we agree earlier implementation dates, and then we go back at follow-up, and actually it's ended up being more involved, and that's what you'll see with us coming back with. They've not been done by that date, but if I haven't got concerns because progress is being made, it's just that things might have taken longer than originally intended. So it's a bit of a two-way discussion and a judgment call as to what the recommendation is.
If it was bad, would you report that to this committee? Would that be reported in some way? Because I know we get the dates of actions and we get the report, as memory serves me, when they are done. We see that, I think, and we occasionally put our hand up because something's not being completed in the time or there's a reason behind it. But at the point where you agree that with the department or the head of service, if you substantially didn't agree or couldn't reach a reasonable position, would you report that in the report? There'd be a comment under the date saying, I, the head of internal audit, don't necessarily agree with this, providing us with the link to investigate that.
Yeah, if we thought it was an unacceptably long time or an unacceptable response,
I'm not sure that we've had it necessarily here, but there will be in some cases where there is a difference of opinion. You know, it is our audit opinion, and it's management's right and responsibility as to how they're going to run their service. So they might not always accept our recommendations or agree with them. So again, we would flag though they would be highlighted if we think that's it would be there anyway. So you would see that. But if we thought that they were taking really an unacceptable level of risk, then I would even more so pull that out in the report to committee. But we haven't had that today.
I guess that comes back to our confidence in the independence of you as our independent person inside on the inside of the audit. So, okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Lisa. I mean, it might be good to think about when we report going forward, that we look at which ones are still outstanding so we can identify if there is potential issues there. I did used to do, the old format did do that, and so it had outstanding ones and overdue ones, but it got quite, I thought it was quite unwieldy, the report, so that's why I've started to focus now just on those that are overdue. But if that's something that would be helpful to committee, I can add that back in. We have our tracker of all the ongoing ones and when we're going to follow up. So we have that. It's just I didn't want the report to be too unwieldy, but we can put it back in if committee would find it helpful.
Maybe if you already do that, it could just be a spreadsheet or however you track it added at the end of the report, if councillors would be happy with that. Okay, we had another question from...
Yeah, it's just occurred to me as we've been going through this meeting that based on my historic experience as an auditor and subsequently as a management consultant, what I came across quite regularly were organisations that were over-controlled, particularly at the lower, less important parts of the business. And as I was reflecting on that, I remembered, and Councillor Parsons may remember this, that the last but one budget scrutiny panel report actually did mention that. And one of the actions was going to be to perhaps identify areas, lower level areas within Charnwood that were over-controlled so that we could strip away some of those perhaps over-bureaucratic controls. Sorry, that was a statement. So my question is not simply to internal audit here, but perhaps it's something for senior management to reflect on as well, as to whether that's something that we could look at going forward as an organisation.
Sorry.
When we are doing internal audits of particular services, it is something that we consider in terms of efficiency and whether the controls are necessary. A lot of the time when we have chats with officers about why particular controls are in place, they might say, well, audit said so. We get that a lot. So then we have a talk about, chat about, well, what is the control trying to achieve? So we would do that through the audits that we're doing, but... As you say, we're not going to audit every service, so there may be something that comes up as part of the service review programme that's happening, because I'm sure that will be looking at efficiencies and ways to streamline services.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Lisa? Sorry to interrupt, because you put your mic.
So, I think I sound quite loud enough. You see, when actually we review, actually, for example, actually the efficiency of pacemakers, we look actually into clinical aspects, the complications, infection rates. We provide graphs, we provide numbers. And of course, even if you go to even more complex matters, the compassion of the nurses actually in the cardiology ward, right? We do actually surveys, you know, feedback from the patients, and we provide metrics. And we compare cardiology ward with nephrology ward. This is what we do in audits. Now, so far, I'm not criticizing anybody, but I'm not satisfied actually that everything is hunky-dory, because I don't really see these things. I don't really see the graphs, the numbers, the comparisons. What I see is actually an audit of wards. Actually, through the actions, we provide you great reassurance. Do I feel reassured? To be honest with you, not very much. I trust you, I respect you, but you know, everything is coming here out of my trust and respect to you as officers. But I don't really see the real numbers, the real comparisons, the graphs. Thank you.
Just respond. It's possibly worth pointing out that with internal audit, our focus is on the governance, risk management, and internal control arrangements, so you wouldn't necessarily see that. If the data is available, then we look at that, and if there are, we will.
If the data is available, then we will compare that. As part of shared service now, we will use our knowledge from the other authorities as well and use that to challenge. But in terms of that full statistical data that you would be looking for, I think that would be great if that was there. And if it was there, we would use that certainly as part of our audit work. To give that view on it, we look at complaints, we look at performance, we look at the performance monitoring side. But in terms of being able to do that as fully as I think you might be talking about, we're not in a position to do that.
I don't want to make a dialogue, but actually, as you said, you look at complaints. Just, I'm grabbing an example here. I mean, it's what we do. We actually have a report comparing actually the rate of complaints every month and how the trend goes up or down. And if actually it goes up, we just try to find the reasons for this. So this is what I'm trying to say.
That would probably go beyond internal audit's role as we are looking at things. That's really then for the service to get into that. We would look at the trend of complaints. We would look at how the service is managing complaints and dealing with them. Does that flag any issues and concerns up to us around the governance of the service, around the risk management or the internal control? But then in terms of the specifics of the complaint, that's for a service to deal with rather than internal audit.
Can I add something to kind of maybe add weight to that? Maybe the difference is looking at what clinical audit roles are different to what internal audit. So within the health service, you will have an internal audit which do a different role, although there is some blurring. Mark will probably confirm that as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That clinical audit is a routine function across all the NHS organisations. It has a, to be honest, it has a broader and deeper remit than I'll try not to use the traditional internal audit, which will look at the controls and the processes. The committee's responsibility is about to act on that. So obviously, yeah, internal audit are there to look at, are the controls functioning effectively? And if that is the case, if that is not the case, to report that for somebody else to deal with. It ensures there's a greater independence between the internal audit function and management doing their work. So it's similar, but different.
Thank you, Mark. I hope that helped in some respect. Okay, thank you, everybody. Is there any more questions?
Brief one there, Lisa. When I look at council tax, page 95, there's a bit there saying there are procedures in place to ensure discounts, exemptions. Just interested to know where fraud fits in with this, in terms of, do you look at the way that these are awarded, and is there any sort of look at to say these are the right people to get the actual awards?
When we do our testing, we do look at that, but obviously we're only looking at a sample. So we also look at this is where it comes, I suppose, to the controls that are in place for the service, so their reviews that they carry out and whether that what they have in place to make sure that the discounts are awarded. So we do substantive testing, which is to look at some and confirm that they are correct, but then we also do some controls testing to make sure that the service has got appropriate arrangements to pick those up, if appropriate verification procedures in place to pick those up as well.
Thank you. Any further questions for Lisa? I'm sure if anybody would like to see exactly what internal audit do, then I'm sure Lisa would welcome you to shadow her or her team on any audit. I'm sure she would extend that welcome to you. Within limits. Okay, are we happy to accept the audit progress report? Thank you very much. Thank you. Are some of the officers leaving us now? Yep, marvellous.
Thank you.
Enjoy your evening. Okay, if we now move on to the allowances and expenses, and I'll hand over to Adrian for this one.
Thank you, Chair. So this is a report we bring to the committee annually. At the same time, we publish the details of members' allowances paid during the previous financial year, as we're required to do by law. I think we bring it to the committee in the interest of openness and transparency. It's a chance for the committee to challenge anything that looks odd. I do know a query has been raised about why some councillors have claimed mileage in a year of virtual meetings and COVID lockdown. And my understanding is the reason for that is councillors have 4 months to submit mileage claims. So when lockdown happened in the second half of March 2020, there could have been mileage claims coming in for the next 3 or 4 months into financial year 2021 that would have been paid in that financial year, but relating to the previous financial year and pre-lockdown. So I think that explains why some councillors receive mileage payments during the year. But happy to answer any questions, Chair.
Thank you, Adrian. Are there any questions?
Me again. How much did we save by not paying actually for travel expenses during the period of the lockdown?
Through you, Chair, not huge amounts, because a lot of our councillors don't claim mileage anyway, even though they're entitled to. Probably in the low thousands, I would guess, maybe £2,000-£3,000 saved. But that's only an estimate, Chair. It's certainly not tens of thousands.
Thank you, Adrian. I'm sure if you want the exact figure, it could be provided as a note, if required.
Well, we could circulate round to the committee the total of mileage claimed for last year compared to maybe the two previous years, if that was of interest to members.
Thank you very much. I'm not interested in the exact amount, but actually, if you save £50,000, it may justify actually to continue with the Zoom meetings. But if it's actually just up to £1,000, it's an insignificant amount of money. So face-to-face meetings are justified. Thank you.
Thank you. Are we happy to agree the recommendations? Lovely, thank you. Okay, if we move on to our next item, which is, I'm sure it's right in the pack. I've got a slight difference in my pack here, sorry. Is it the anti-fraud? It's not the anti-fraud, is it? The environmental ordinance.
According to my agenda, Chair, the next item is the annual update on the anti-fraud and corruption strategy and whistleblowing policy.
Yes, that's what I thought it was going to be. Yep, thank you, sorry. Okay, Adrian, over to you.
Again, Chair, this is an annual summary report we bring to the Committee for Information. The anti-fraud and corruption strategy and whistleblowing policies have been reviewed, and we're not recommending they require any changes. There were no whistleblowing reports during financial year 2021, but as summarised within the report, there were some frauds identified relating to COVID grants. A substantial proportion of that money has now been reclaimed. If there are any general questions, I'll try and answer them, but if there are more specific questions about those frauds, I will have to defer to Lisa as our internal audit manager or Simon as our Section 151 officer. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian. Any questions?
With regard to fraud surrounding the COVID grants, are we confident we might recover the remaining £65,000 or will that be written off?
No. I will say that the volume of grants we've given out has been very, very extensive. So over £37 million over a number of thousands of grants, literally thousands of grants. And the government, as you may recall from the communications around that time, were very keen for us to pay as quickly as possible, which we did. So I think most of the issues we've had, actually, and Lisa would probably confirm this, were within the very early weeks of paying out. Subsequently, we've, in line with the government instruction, and as we've gone along, but we've been able to introduce better prepayment checks. So now I think we're in a stronger position, but we do rely still on self-certification of grant claimants, the alternative being a very heavy bureaucratic process, and in some ways would be very difficult for us to evaluate anyway. So things like how much turnover or profit as a business loss, it's very, very difficult for us to evaluate on the basis of any information we may get. So, we've made every effort to recover the grants. There's still an issue about who will bear this, so we believe, having paid them out in good faith, that the Treasury will stand behind these issues. Some of them are not necessarily frauds, they're due to sort of confusions with the schemes, which are many, various and quite complicated. So I think we are doing our best to both prevent fraud and to recover in line with our standard procedures, but it's not to say, are we going to get it all back? I think that would be very optimistic, I'm afraid.
Got another question.
I know you mentioned the Treasury are likely to stand behind it. Do we know when they're likely to say, and will it become a liability in the budget when we start working through the budget for next year?
We don't know when they'll say. I think that's fair to say. I think it's fair that we don't know when they'll say. The noise is from BEIS, who are the Business in Education, Industrial and Skills contacts we have in the East Midlands, are that it should be okay, providing we can demonstrate that we have paid things in good faith, and I'm pretty confident around that, but we don't know for certain. There is some discretionary grants, and advice we've had from BEIS is that if there are any overpayments that we've made, we can potentially use some of the discretionary grant funding to offset that. Now, clearly that's not ideal, in that we would obviously like to give grants out to deserving deserving cases, but there is a little bit of flexibility there. So I don't anticipate any huge liabilities within the accounts that we would have to cover.
Thank you, Simon. Any further questions? No? Are we happy to agree the recommendations? Thank you. If we move on next to the environmental audit, and I think we've got some more visitors. So, welcome. We have Councillor Rawlings, Richard Bennett and Maria French. So when they're in and settled, we will hand over to Richard and Maria to introduce the report. Welcome to the Audit Committee. Hand over to you guys.
Thank you, Chair. Councillor Rawlings here. Just a very brief introduction from me, so thank you for taking the time to listen to us. This report is, of course, an annual report, and it looks at the Council's compliance with environmental regulations and the environmental impact arising from our activities and operations. I was quite pleased, looking through the report this year, that we do have a relatively small number of issues, which are all, as you can see from the report, being addressed quite adequately. And it was reassuring to note that compliance remains very good despite everything that's happened over the last year or so, and the impacts of home working and things like that. Despite that, compliance has remained very high. So I'll hand over to Richard Bennett, who will explain a bit more about the purpose of this report, and then we'll be able to take any questions on the detail. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Rawlings, and through you, Chair. Not much more to say, really. The audits are designed to check the legal compliance and implementation of the Council's environmental management system in its own building estate. We do it annually, as Councillor Rawlings said, with six-month reviews. We share the results of the audits with the building managers, and also the recommendations for mitigating any non-compliance, and they are prioritised in relation to risk. So the audit that you've got before you shows the activities that might be an environmental risk excuse me, and categorises them in one of three ways. Firstly, whether it's a non-conformance with requirements, a so-called NCR, where there's a breach of or a lack of evidence for a particular requirement, whether it's an issue, where there's perhaps a lack of best practice, or whether there's just a recommendation. And that's really where there's an issue or there is potential for there being a non-conformance, which needs addressing to prevent it from getting any worse. So in this year's audit, there were six non-conformances noted, with improvement plans that are already in place, 14 issues identified and six recommendations. So that's an overarching summary, Chair. Maria French, who is our officer who leads on this area of work, is available if you've got any particular questions about the audit. I want to know anything more about it in any more detail. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Are there any questions?
Just a general point. This report on the environmental audit is specific only to the buildings on the estate, the council's buildings. So, for example, the picking up of the new waste fleet wouldn't be picked up if there are any environmental issues here, because this is just buildings. And we own that fleet, so there is an environment impact of the fleet, but this is just buildings.
Yes, it is just for the operational control of the buildings. It doesn't include other, in terms of other departments, and so, for example, housing, and as you say, the fleet, that would be managed by those departments and any environmental impacts of those. So this is just for the actual buildings that we own and manage.
Actually, this covers a bit of my question, because you see, I have two questions. The first question is actually in Mount Sorrel, there is a quarry, and there is actually this quarry is expanding. Has anybody done actually an evaluation of the impact on the environment? This is the first question. The second question I have is, as we all know, we have now the guidance to proceed with more developments in the region. So we expect actually to provide more houses with the new estates. Has anybody evaluated actually the impact on the environment because of this rapid expansion of Changwood?
Through you, Chair. So this, the Council's environmental management system is specifically about managing its own building estate. So the points you're raising about the Mount Sorrel Quarry and the housing in the borough falls under different regulatory regimes. It's not within the Council's specific control. So the Mount Sorrel Quarry, for example, the planning permission that operates under is falls under the powers of the County Council as the Minerals Planning Authority. I would expect that there would be a environmental impact assessment as part of that planning permission, which would have looked at the issues of you know, the environmental impacts arising from those operations that are authorised in association with that plan permission. So further information about that would be available from the County Council. And in terms of housing development and housing growth, that would fall under the local planning authority at Charnwood. major residential developments would be subject to environmental impact assessment as part of the planning application process. Where the impacts on a range of environmental factors would be considered when taking a decision whether to grant planning permission or not. Housing development, which is coming forward through a development plan environment, would be subject to sustainability appraisal and also other environmental controls through the development plan process. So, members may be aware that the local plan is coming before Cabinet this week, and in the pack of information that's accompanying the Cabinet report is an appendices that deals with sustainability appraisal and you know, other environmental impacts, so that information is available.
Thank you, Richard. That's a full response. Does that answer your queries? Lovely. Any more questions on this? No? Are we happy to accept the recommendations?
Yep.
Yes? Thank you, Councillor Rawlings, Richard and Maria. Thank you. Okay, if we move on to the next item, which is risk management and the risk register update. And I'll hand you over to Simon to introduce this report. Thank you, Simon.
Chair Helen Gretton is here to introduce that one specifically. So may instantly pass the buck to Helen.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you, Chair. This is the Council's Strategic Risk Register and COVID Risk Register, which are presented to committee on a quarterly basis. In between committee sessions, the registers are reviewed by the senior leadership team and corporate leadership teams, also on a quarterly basis. Since the last review by the committee, no new risks have been added or removed, but the ratings have been updated in accordance with external changes, most notably the COVID risk register in terms of the changing landscape around restrictions and recovery. Happy to take any questions on either of the registers. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions on the registers? No, I think I would like to confirm, given some of the questions we had earlier, that internal audit will use this risk register in order to inform planning for the year ahead for your audits, which might tie up some of the earlier questions.
We do look at the risk register, yeah, when we're planning our work, but that's one element of it, so we keep an eye on that, and also from our discussions and review of minutes and another information that we have about what may be risk areas as well, but may not necessarily feature on the strategic risk register. But yes, we do. We're also doing a risk management audit, as Councillor Bolton asked as well the other day. That's on the audit plan for quarter two or quarter three.
Thank you, Lisa. Are there any other questions on this? No questions? Are we happy to accept the recommendations in here?
Yeah.
Yep. Lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, our next item is the Council's use of REPA, and I'll hand over to Adrian.
Thank you, Chair. As ever, this is the quarterly highlight of the committee's agenda, in that once again we have not used REPA in the previous quarter, as for many, many years we haven't used it. It might just be informative for the committee to note that we are due our four-yearly external independent inspection to make sure we are using RIPA appropriately, so at some point, maybe by the next committee meeting, you'll have an independent report telling us. I don't know what they're going to tell us, given that we haven't used it, Chair, and we continue not to use it. It'd probably be a desktop review. That's what they did last time. I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any.
We have one question.
Thank you, Chair. Adrian, just to check on page 167, are the dates under the recommendation correct? Because it takes us from 1st of September last year to 30th of November, and we're now at the beginning of June.
I think that's an error, Chair, so I apologise for that, and you need to move that forward 3 months. So it will be December to the end of February. Apologies for that, Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Are we happy to agree the recommendations following the update to the date?
No.
Thank you. And if we move on to the next item, which is the Treasury Outturn Report, and I'll hand over to Leslie to introduce this.
Thank you, Chair. Page 170 is the Treasury Management Outturn Report for 2020. The actual Treasury Management Report covers the main items, such as the summary details of the capital expenditure against the budget in the year. The report covers the levels of internal and external borrowing for the year, and the level of net debt for the council. Also, the report covers the investment outturn position. I'd like to just point out on page 172, one of the main points to bring to your attention, which is the capital expenditure, the budget on the general fund. On page 172, the budget was 57.8 million against a spend of 30 million. Which leaves a balance of 27.8 million, so that's a significant underspend in the year. Heads of service have highlighted and included in the capital outturn report there is a slippage request of £25.4 million, which I have details of with me this evening to go through should you wish to see that list. So that leaves a balance of an underspend of £2.4 million, which will go back into the capital plan. As I say, the slippage report for £25.4 million will be reported to Cabinet on the 1st of July. The HRA is in a similar position where the budget was £9 million against a spend of £4 million, so a balance there of £5 million. The slippage request is £2 million. The underspend of £3 million will fall back into the HRA financing fund. Just to bring your attention to page 182, which is the investment outturn report. The interest earned for the year is £342,000 against a revised budget of £300,000. Last year we did actually outturn at £562,000. Given that the rates have actually dropped very low, we've actually made some good returns on our external property funds of £182,000 and then internally managed funds of £160,000, and we've actually reset the budget for next year at a similar level of £300,000. So I'm happy to take any questions on this report this evening, or should you wish to have a copy of the slippage details and a copy of the £57 million capital budget. I've got papers with me this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. One point, can I just mention on page 174, should the table say the 31st March 2020 rather than 2019, the heading on the table, on the first table? Page 174. The gross borrowing against the CFR. It says the 31st of March 2019 actual.
So
that's the 2019.
So the revised budget is for...
Right, okay, yep. Sorry, get you.
It's 31st of March 21, but it's actually for the year for 20.
My packet says it's 2019. Oh, so it was used.
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, thank you. Just didn't know if that should have been 2020. Thank you. Okay. I think slippage in the current climate is to be expected, given everything that we've probably been through in terms of capital expenditure.
And some very large slippage. Shall I run through the figures, Simon?
If I can just explain, page 172, the budget was set at £57 million. So on the left-hand side of the supplementary paper, you can actually see the budgets that were set, £25 million on commercialisation, all the way down to the £57 million. And on the right-hand side, against those schemes, is the £25,436,000 that's actually been taken to the capital outturn report as slippage. So you can see some sort of very large figures in there, so bed Bedford Square, 1.5 million. Enterprise Zone, 15 million. That requires external borrowing. And the town deal stroke regeneration budget, which is 4.7 million. Just to point out this evening that we have actually received some confirmation today that the town deal application has been approved, and we should be getting 17 million to add to our capital plan. So that's a very, it's a very good sort of news, good news story for today. Does anybody else have any questions?
Killesley, I think we have a question.
Thank you for the presentation. Now, it seems actually underspent has been a common theme for this council for quite some time, apart from 1 year, if I remember well. Now, in the past, we used this underspend as reassurance for future challenges. And that was in one of the reports of the budget scrutiny. What is the plan with the underspend money now? What is the exact plan? And why this underspend keeps occurring?
I'll attempt to answer that. So there's two areas of underspend. One is on the revenue budget, and I think that's the one where if there's an underspend, that would basically flow back into our general fund working balance, and that enables us to use it as a cushion in future years. And that has been a historical trend with the council until maybe the last year or so as funding positions got ever tighter. This is capital, and again, we have got a long tradition of underspending. I think there's two or three things within the list we have here. So one is there will be some projects that haven't quite progressed as quickly as we may have originally envisaged, and you could argue there's maybe some project management lessons to be learnt there, and I think we are trying to do that, and that's what we're trying to do through the capital reporting. And there have been some procedures introduced internally amongst the senior officer group, so we can get a bit more of a grip of those. Some of these things are just sort of naturally difficult. So, for example, Bedford Square has been just the progress of that hasn't quite been to plan. I think it's one of those things where you start digging up the road and you don't necessarily know what you're going to find underneath. But you know, if you've been around the sort of Bedford Square area, you'll see that's being dug up and in progress. So there's a sort of clear rationale for carrying that forward. Some of the other areas, particularly some of the very large numbers, reflect the council's commitment to do things but without necessarily being live projects. So the largest of those is the 50 million for the enterprise zone, and that the expenditure of that money depends on two enterprise zone sites, being Loughborough University Science and Enterprise Park, or Charnwood Campus, the former AstraZeneca site, coming forward with schemes that pass muster with the LEP, and then subsequently are then eligible for forward funding, which we do. So at the precise time of the 31st of March, we hadn't paid any money out in this area, though actually in April we were able to provide forward funding to Charnwood Campus for £2 million. So if you actually were to look as of today, that balance is now down at £30 million. Town deal regeneration budget, we've spent a little bit against that, but most of the original £5 million for the 2021 year remains unspent. There is another £10 million that's due to be spent in this financial year. Now, whether we will do it or not is a moot point, but it's there available for all us to spend and to take advantage of opportunities that may arise. And actually, we've obviously, as Leslie just mentioned, we've had £17 million from the town deal, so that will have a material impact on our capital plan when we've actually assimilated the detail of that and updated that. But when we've done that, we've got this we'll have a thick end of £15 million to supplement the £17 million from the town deal. So hopefully we will be able to make a real difference to the to the borough. Again, the timing of that, though, it may not be, I think, inevitably, given the amount of sums involved, it is available to spend, but I think being realistically, we may not spend it all by the end of 31 March 2022. So I hope that made a little bit of sense.
Thank you, Simon. And I think given some of the risks that we saw in the earlier agenda item on the risk register and the way risks have moved up, I think being financially prudent will stand us in good stead to be able to address some of those.
Could I just add to Simon's comment about we have introduced a capital monitoring process, which actually now three times a year, and as well as outturn, the actual capital monitoring does filter through to SLT. SLT have got more control on that plan and what's not performing, whereas in the past we've had a capital monitoring project team. So we've actually now moved that directly to SLT. So that's something that we've put in place recently to make sure that we keep on top of all the schemes. So that's something internally that we've just introduced. Thank you.
Thank you. I've got two more questions. Councillor Parsons, Councillor.
Just to test my understanding, really. The S106s are the developer's contribution, I guess. Are some of those time limited, and do you do any work on when they're actually coming to fruition, if you like, or when they run out so we lose the money? So is there some sort of way that we understand that and we're not going to lose some of this 785,000 million? No, thousand. Sorry.
Yes, that is the Section 106 money is the development funding monies, and also some external grant money there. The Section 106 is monitored internally. Again, quarterly, there's a team of officers, and Eileen Mallon, the director, chairs that meeting, and we invite external parties, the NHS and the police, and obviously the schemes are, quite a few of the schemes are project managed in conjunction with parish councils as well. So that is monitored, and the time limit. We do monitor that time limit as well on as part of the project. I sit on that project board as well. So from a finance point of view, from an officer point of view, from an external party point of view, we do come together on a quarterly basis for that.
Can I just ask over this last year or whatever, have we ever lost any money in terms of running out of time, or they've reclaimed it back because we've not used it?
I don't believe we have. That's something I could double check, but I don't believe we've had to pay any money back to a developer.
Thank you. Councillor Paul.
Thank you. I have two questions. I'm going to go in reverse order, so I'm going to go to the one that's furthest in the papers first, because I think it's easier to answer. The second one might be a little bit more complicated. I just want to flag to members that with regard to the property funds, I understand it's a long-term investment, so I get that. And we made 300 and whatever we did net return, but we also lost 253 capital in the fair valuation of the two funds this year, according to those figures. And I recognise it's a long term and property funds will fluctuate. Does that mean, and now I'm into accounting territory which I don't fully understand, under the paragraph which follows it, IFRS 9, Fair Value of Investments, am I going to see in the outturn accounts a reserve figure tucked away as a liability in a reserve fund of that 253 capital reduction in fair value of the two property funds? Is that what that's telling me in that paragraph about IFRS 9. So I'm actually going to see that, because we have a duty for transparency to put a liability in a reserve fund of that 253 capital reduction.
If I can just answer that, Councillor Parsons. IFRS 9, there is a five-year sort of overriding rule, if you like, that this investment losses, valuation losses, as they stand, don't hit the bottom line, and we actually do in the final accounts, we actually account for those valuation losses. So we have got an account called an unusable reserve. So we do actually account for those, but it doesn't actually hit any of our general fund reserve balances. That's something that we obviously got to monitor and keep an eye on, because it says 5 years from the 1st of April 2018. We've put those valuations in for transparency purposes, because we do need to monitor those closely. But as we've said, we are taking some good returns on the rental of those, and that's something that we will monitor each quarter when we do the Treasury Management quarterly reports.
Yeah, and recognise that. I understand it's a long-term investment. Recognise we get good return from it.
Sorry, I'm sorry. No, sorry. I know. I think the point I was just trying to make was, will it be visible and labelled as an unusable reserve when we see the outturn accounts? I'd like to be able to see a line, unusable reserve, £253,000.
It won't actually be in the outturn report. It will be in the statement of accounts, because it doesn't actually affect our bottom line, as in we're not taking that money out of our reserves. It will actually be a line in the statement of accounts.
Second question, if I may, might be slightly more difficult, or it might be really easy to answer, I don't know. On page 174, I'm trying to understand how we get a negative cost as a proportion of the net revenue stream for financing the general fund, and such a high percentage for the financing of the HRA account. I don't understand how, particularly the negative one, and I'm hoping there'll be something that I can understand better about the high HRA figure.
It's so the HRA figure is more obvious, because there's basically lots of debt and the interest rate is there. So that's relatively easy. The negative one is an odd one, because our interest receivable is higher than our interest payable. So it creates a net. So basically the investment income of 300,000 exceeds the interest we pay. So that's why it looks odd. So it's 300,000 revenue coming in, and it's 11.25% of the 2 million we borrowed in 1986 or whenever it was, 1984, I think. So basically interest receivable exceeds interest payable, giving an odd-looking metric there.
Thank you. Accounting adjustments. Any other questions? No? Thank you, Simon and Leslie. Are we happy to accept the recommendations? Lovely, thank you very much. We're almost getting towards the end, and are there any issues so far that the committee wishes to forward to Scrutiny Commission to consider?
Work programme.
I'll ask that again after we've looked at work programme. Sorry. Over to Adrian to introduce this report.
Thank you, Chair. This is really for the committee to be aware of the ongoing work programme, and for you to think about whether there's anything that's arisen this evening that you would like to either add to the work programme or that would cause you to change the work programme. The second action is probably not very clearly worded. And just for information, the external quality assessment of internal audit was considered at the February meeting, so it's not something that you need to worry about tonight. Thanks.
Have you got any questions on the work programme for Adrian?
Could I just ask Adrian, I've looked through this and of course I'm new to the actual committee. Do we look at the Ombudsman report as well as audit?
The annual summary of Ombudsman findings is actually something that goes to full council. Right. So it doesn't come here. I think the recommended best practice is that myself as the monitoring officer does report it to full council annually, so all 52 councillors are aware of what the Ombudsman has been looking at in any of their findings.
Can I add into that? I'm sure if there was any risk areas, they would then follow through into the risk report, which would then come here. That's what I hope would be the process.
One tiny point, just to understand, because I'm not actually sure whether it's got relevance or not. The very final paragraph on page 184, is that the commercial investments should be monitored and reported by the audit committee or to the audit committee? So, in other words, have we got a responsibility for reporting back what it is, or are we just having it reported to us for consideration?
I think, Chair, this relates to the next item on the agenda, the exempt report, and this was a recommendation from the Budget Scrutiny Panel that the income from commercial investment should be monitored either by the Audit Committee and or by the Scrutiny Commission, and that's why the report that's coming to you and the exempt item on the appendix is coming to you, Chair.
It's my misreading of it. I'm reading it as by us, as opposed to by one of or the other, in terms of the way I'm reading it. That's why I was confused, and not to us. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Adrian. Are there any other questions at all? Or are we happy to confirm the recommendations? Yep. Lovely. Okay. This is the point where I should have asked you about whether there was any other issues that you wish to forward to scrutiny. No? We're now moving on to the exempt information within the park.